Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast again. This is episode 28, and it's a big one for me, honestly. I didn't really know where this journey was going to take me once I started this podcast. But what I wanted to do today is, first and foremost, celebrate my 1 year kidney auto transplant anniversary. Now, as of the day of this recording, it's December 24th. My 1 year anniversary was December 19th. On that day, though, I was traveling 8 hours in a car with Kyle to go pick up a work truck for him. We did go get dinner that night at a nice restaurant in Lincoln, Nebraska. We did celebrate, but I really wanted to make sure I enshrined this year milestone, not only for myself, but for some of you who might be curious. How the heck is she doing? And what are some of the updates along this year, some obstacles that she has ran across, some enhancements that maybe life has gotten better? And I have to just say, before I get into the nitty-gritty of not only think some of the challenges and then the things I've learned along the way, but if we were looking at a scale here, the scale is definitely tipping more toward the positive side of things. I have my life back. I'm a lot more active, as in like not horizontal 80% of the day. So we'll get into the nitty-gritty of those. I've made a list here that I'm going to be referencing to hopefully be as comprehensive as possible. And my hope with this episode is to help you all see that year-long snapshot, the 365 days between the day of my auto transplant until now, and what changes have been there. And for some of you all that have maybe been on the fence, for example, on should I do an auto transplant, should I not, hopefully this can give you some clarity, whatever clarity that is for you. To start, I'll have to say I want to, again, I'm going to lean on a lot of positives. I have also gotten some new diagnoses this year, which I'm are actually pretty fresh, pretty raw. I know I was just crying this morning about them. So here we are. Now, for some of the positives, I want to start out. My kidney numbers are so much better. They are like smack dab in the middle of the green. So, you know, when you get your MyChart results back and you bring it up and they have, you know, the green is in the middle. My numbers are very awesome now. My GFR has increased. I was, for just to give you a bit of a reference, prior to my auto transplant, I wasn't necessarily in kidney disease per se, but I was definitely in what some doctors called like the yellow space. So I did have lower GFRs that were in the kind of between that 60-70 range. So it wasn't, I was never diagnosed with actually like you have kidney disease, but I was inching that way. And if you look at my trends prior to my auto transplant, every time I went to the ER, which was kind of frequently, as we all know, when you're dealing with that level of pain, and then sometimes either you have the diagnosis or you don't yet, the trend was all my GFR numbers were like started out at 110 and then they just kept declining, kept declining, kept declining. Then I got my auto transplant and it shot right back up. It was like transplants are crazy. They're like a plug and play situation. It shot back up and my GFR has stayed in the green since. I think the lowest I've logged is like a 98, 95, maybe somewhere in the 90s. I don't think maybe I've logged an 88 at one of those times. But that was also kind of, I had a bit of an infection going on too, but they've stayed great. They've stayed in the green and that's been awesome. I have another positive here is a big symptom for me leading into the auto transplant when my body was just at its worst was my POTS. I never got a formal diagnosis of POTS because it was really tricky trying to get a tilt table test and all the other testing I was having to do just to get approved to have an auto transplant. But I very much know that I had POTS and it was very severe. It was not good. A lot of dizziness, a lot of, I never actually passed out, but I did have a lot of what the doctors call like hypotension events, but it was definitely a POTS related event. And then once I had my auto transplant, I finally was able to get in with electrophysiologist here in the Denver area, Dr. Finta, and he's wonderful. I wasn't actually able to get in him for 6 months, so there's no way I could have gotten into him prior to my auto transplant. And I wish I could have, just so I could have that data. Again, I'm a professor, I'm a researcher. I love having data to be able to compare and contrast. However, I can use my symptoms, which is I know I have, since the auto transplant, been formally diagnosed with POTS. That was about 6 months post-op. I was finally able to have that appointment. They didn't even do a tilt table test on me because this particular doctor talked about how barbaric that test can be. To strap you onto a table and almost kind of force you to pass out is not something he likes to do to his clients. It can be very traumatizing, and I also agree. So he has this test that he does in his office where you lie down for a certain number of minutes, and it's about a 30-minute situation where you have to lie down, sit, stand up. They do your blood pressure, the whole nine yards. And that was when he diagnosed me with a moderate POTS. He's like, looking at what your numbers are, you do have POTS, and I'm seeing it as being moderate. And I let him know. I said, well, that's really interesting because these symptoms were so much worse prior to my auto transplant. He confirmed that yes, POTS can be exacerbated by vascular compressions and blood not getting back to your heart. And then this is what I'm really excited about. I had that 6 months post-op. I was originally diagnosed, and then we waited 3 more months. He said, let's do a follow-up in 3 months and then have you come back and we'll retest you and just see how the intervention, which it was very easy, it was just increase my salt intake, increase my water intake. And that I did. And I did that just by doing like liquid IVs and my water. I have a 40 ounce water bottle that I try to drink at a minimum 2 of those full a day. And then I also just use it to justify eating more French fries. So, I go back at the 9 months post-op from my auto transplant, but 3 months after being officially diagnosed with POTS, and they do the exact same test on me. And he walks in and he's like, girl, you prep these numbers are basically like, he's like, it's not that you don't have POTS because you do. And he was like, but de the intervention's definitely working. And like, you're at like mild to like barely f experiencing symptoms. And I said, yeah, I agree with that. I have, my symptoms have gone down dramatically. I do have every now and then an episode, and it usually is very much correlated with I'm dehydrated, my water intake isn't what it needs to be, I need to increase my salt, things like that. So that's really exciting. Kind of a snapshot of prior to getting my auto transplant, my POTS was just horrendous. After my auto transplant, went to moderate, and then now we're at mild, and I'm barely experiencing symptoms. It was also very crazy because people like us who have vascular compressions, one of the things I think is really neat about this space, and you might not find yourself saying that so often, but I do think it's a whatever you want to call it, a blessing that I intimately know, some of us intimately know what it feels like for blood to not properly flow through your body. And it's painful and it's heavy and it's toxic and it's suffocating and it's so many different words. And then when I had the auto transplant, I remember it was like kind of a psychedelic experience where I woke up and I was like, holy shit, this is what blood's supposed to feel like. But you wouldn't know the opposite if you didn't have that experience, right? And so now I look at all these people just walking around, no vascular compressions. I'm like, you don't even understand what your blood's doing for you right now. You have no idea. You don't even know what it feels like when your blood doesn't work properly, when it's not pumping properly because there are compressions. And so it's given me a new appreciation for my body. So that is something I do want to say is like, I've always been a grateful person, I've always been a positive person. But it's helped me to interact with my body in a different way and to really be so, I don't know, I think it's such a blessing again for what or whatever word you want to insert there to have that experience, to intimately know what it feels like for your body to be decaying because of the blood and the toxicity that's there, to then go have the auto transplant to be like, wow, I am so grateful that I know the opposite of this. And I can feel the blood coursing through my body, and it makes me feel powerful. And so I have that reference point. Some of the things that have, well, let me, before I jump in there, I'm going to talk about kind of the positives. I'll say my energy profile has been a lot better. So my days, I don't wake up with left flank pain anymore. It's not the thing waking me up like it did every single day, other than the day after my renal hyalur block. That's when I knew that I needed an auto transplant was good for me. But my energy profile is a lot better. One thing I do want to say is I am like a lot of women, and I'll kind of weave in the new diagnoses I've gotten. I did decide to go see a psychiatrist after the auto transplant. I believe I might have said this in another episode before, but I did have, when I was inpatient at UW Health, I think it was day five, Kyle took me downstairs in a wheelchair, and I went to the gift shop and I actually ran into another transplant patient there. He came up to me, he was like, "You look like a transplant patient." And we started chatting, and at the very end, he said, "Don't underestimate the anxiety and the depression that come after this." And I was like, "Oh, interesting." I didn't say anything to him about, like, well, I'm not a traditional transplant person, meaning like this is my own organ. I'm on not on immunosuppressants. So I just said, "Oh, thanks for letting me know. Like, we got to stick together, you know." But about 3 months after, like, I was doing really well, and the depression and the anxiety very much started creeping in. Now, that could have been intersected by, my hormones, which the hormones was also a very interesting thing as a smidge of a side note, and then I'll give once you find out what I tell you what my diagnosis is, it's gonna be hilarious because I'm actually demonstrating it to you right now. I'll start with that. So he tells me I go see a psychiatrist. I'm seeing them. I go on antidepressants. It's helping me just kind of get through. I also was diagnosed with CPTSD when I was 27. So my PTSD is also kicking in. Get medication for that. And then she looks at me and she's like, "Have you ever been told you have ADD?" Right? Again, these tangents I'm going on with you. Here we are. And I'm actually realizing I haven't taken my Vyvanse today. And here's my last little pill. So I'll do that. But she diagnoses me with ADD. And I'm like, okay, so I start my Vyvanse, and that really changed the landscape of my being. Not from a like, it helped my depression. I mean, it did actually help my anxiety because it helped me to not ruminate so much. And it really positively affected so many avenues of my life. But that was a new diagnosis. But going and seeing that psychiatrist was something that I'm so glad I did. I come from a family that's pretty, they're not anti-medicine per se, but they definitely have a lot of narratives around taking medicine, taking those psychiatric meds were a bit of like having to deal with my ego there. So that was something that I wanted to bring up, the ADD medication and me being on Vyvanse, a low dose, 10 milligrams, which works really well for me. Oh no, actually this is 20 milligrams. We upped it. But that has also obviously helped my energy profile. When you're able to actually focus on what needs to get done, my brain fog has gotten a lot better. Now, something I do want to say though is my hormones, I have hypothyroidism, or actually, let me back up. I have something called low T3 syndrome. So, not full blown hypothyroidism. However, they treat low T3 syndrome, similar to hypothyroidism. So, I take thyroid medication. So, how much is my ADD diagnosis, the ADD coming about and being stronger for me, intersected as the hormones started getting worse and I was getting into my menopausal journey. Now, something I do want to share with you all that was an update similar to POTS, which is that it was severe prior to the AT, then it got moderate, and now it's mild. My hormone profile was also interesting because prior to my AT, I went and did a massive hormone panel, found out about the low T3 syndrome. But I was told I was perimenopausal. And that was when I was 34 years old. So I'm like, that's not great. I go and do that exact same, I have my yearly exam, go do the exact same hormone panel post-operatively, post-auto transplant. And my hormones like went backwards. Now I'm still in the menopausal journey, but I went from peri to premenopausal. I'll take it. I'll fucking take it. Okay. So some of these things were very interesting when you, and why I think it's very important, and I want to share that is if you can get those data points pre fixing your nutcracker syndrome, whatever that is, transplant, auto transplant, left renal vein stent or transplantation. It's so interesting when you can have the baseline, or maybe I shouldn't even say baseline, but you can just have the data pre-op and then go and see those same specialists. redo those scans to see how have things either improved or not. And for me, it does seem like the majority of things have improved. My POTS has improved significantly. My hormones do seem to be a little bit more in balance, which makes sense. I mean, blood is the life force. And when there's a kink in the system, just like plumbing, it's going to fuck up the rest of the system. So, those are a couple good things. My brain fog has gotten better as well. So again, is that hormone related? Is that that I'm on Vyvanse now, right? Like, I don't know that study. I haven't, submitted all my data into SPSS, which is a statistical analysis program, to see what is the correlations and things like that. But I can say energy is better, brain fog's better. I'm very, very minimal muscular skeletal pain. I was starting to develop levoscoliosis at the thoracolumbar junction, which was very interesting. It almost looked like my spine was being pulled toward the problem, toward it was right there where my left renal vein was. Anytime I'd get a massage or acupuncture, anytime somebody would touch that area, it would just rear its nasty head. It would be so much worse. And now I don't have that problem. I'm not having muscular skeletal issues. I can handle massages a lot better, acupuncture. I don't have that pain at the thoracolumbar junction where my muscles are trying to protect the problem because the problem's not there anymore. I'm not really seeing, again, like I've always had chronic lower back pain, and some of that is like, right, endometriosis is something I was diagnosed with. May Thurner, but then I also got the stent for that. So my back pain did get exponentially better after that. But one of the things I want to say is, well, what happens when you relocate your kidney to that, to your pelvic region? I have not really know. I don't notice it. I don't notice it. I really truly don't. It doesn't pop up for me. But again, because I don't have a kidney like, located in that left side, I don't have any more left flank pain, and I'll take it. I'm not having more recurrent chronic UTI symptoms. And what I mean by that is I've had to do, so at least at UW Health, they make you do a 3 month, 6 month, and a 12 month lab follow-up, which is your metabolic panel, your CBC, and your urinalysis. And for all of those, other than I had one at 3 months that came back abnormal, but it was also because I had a kidney stone in my right kidney that was noted to be there prior to my auto transplant. So they think some of the stress of the transplant kind of broke that kidney, the stone up. So some of that came out in my urinalysis. But since then, my urinalysis has been great. There has been no more protein or blood in my urine, which has been awesome. Prior to my auto transplant, there was. I have had a couple urinary tract infection-y type things that I was easily able to remedy by just using the azoles over-the-counter pills. Now, with that being said, I have a very close relationship with my primary care doc. So whenever I also bought the pH balance, like pee sticks that you can pee on to tell you have a urinary tract infection. So he let me know. He said, hey, because you had your kidney, not only is your ureter shorter, but whenever they move the ureter, it compromises the valve where your ureter meets your bladder, to where it doesn't do as good of a job at making sure that the urine not only doesn't retroactively come up your ureter, but also your ureter is shorter. So your kidney's closer. So looking at, you have a higher risk of nephrosis. It can happen more quickly as well. So there's like those small things that you have to learn about your body. And I have noticed them, like the first sign of a potential bladder infection, if I don't pretty fucking promptly deal with it, I can like pretty closely feel my kidney getting involved. So there is some of that. It's not necessarily to scare you, but it's just saying like prior when I'd have bladdery things going on, I wasn't as like urgent about it in my brain. Now that doesn't mean I didn't go to the doctor, but I was just like, I never really would have azoles on me, right? I didn't have the pH sticks that you could pee on. Versus now, I'm like, oh, nope, you want to have them in your emergency purse kit type of a thing. So I've only had to do antibiotics once for a urinary tract infection, and that happened around like the 4 to 5 months, I think. And that was when my primary care was like, hey, you're going to be one of those people that probably just needs to have those pH sticks and azoles on you pretty regularly. And ever since then, there was only one other instance where I started feeling like I was having a urinary tract infection. And some of that was just feeling a frequency of needing to go. Popped an azoles, felt fine. Nothing came from it. So, there are those things to consider and remember that there are risk factors to having an auto transplant. One of them is that there are people that have demonstrated to have actually a higher recurrent chronic engagement with UTIs post auto transplant because of the shortened ureter and the compromised valve. So just keep that in mind. For me, I haven't really had problems with it. I've been doing good. Again, some of it could just be because my intervention for POTS is elevating my water intake. So I'm keeping my kidneys flushed, keeping them as healthy as possible. I'm not having any more chest pain either. I was in the ER a couple, one time specifically, but I was having like pulmonary embolism symptoms. I did go to the ER once. I was told it wasn't a pulmonary embolism, which obviously is wonderful. But I think all of us can agree that the really scary thing about vascular compressions, at least what was really scary for me, is I felt like at any moment I could throw a blood clot. At any moment, a blood clot could be forming. At any moment, I could die. Like that's what's so scary about it, is when you're talking about a compression and blood, and there is talks of DVTs being thrown around. And so, I was having very deep chest pain. Now, as a reminder, my collateral veins were, and this also goes back to that levoscoliosis. My collateral veins were actually had inched their way into my spinal column at the thoracolumbar junction and were moving their way up my spine. So I don't know how much, I mean, this is me spitballing. Okay. So if medical doctors listen to this, you're probably just like, this bitch doesn't know what she's talking about. That levoscoliosis of my spine starting to curve to the left at that thoracolumbar junction. I don't know how much of it was that those collateral veins were almost pulling it towards the problem. Of course, when you get an auto transplant, one of the things they're going to say is, yeah, we'll take out some of those collateral veins, but we're not spine surgeons either. So we're not opening your spine to go get that collateral. They were also going down my left side. So I was having a lot of deep burning on my left side. So not just the flank, but like almost think like coming around the side of my body towards the front left side. They were going up into my chest. And so that's why we think the pulmonary embolism, kind of that waking up in the middle of the night, couldn't really breathe. My chest was hurting really bad. I haven't had any issues like that. And I was also having a lot of left leg pain issues. And when I say pain, I was very suspect, and this was also working with my physical therapist on this, which was I was having just these deep aching, like from the hip, almost like sciatica is what it felt like. Was going to PT, was doing all the stuff, and nothing was helping. And I finally found this new PT that was like, hey, like you have Nutcracker. She showed me the diagram of like the nerve bundles that come off of the kidney and actually collide with the nerve bundles, like can cause pressure on the leg nerve bundles. So when I had my auto transplant, that sciatica pain went away, which was awesome. I was just like, oh, thank God. That sciatic pain had been my nemesis for like 5 years. And I always thought it was like mechanical. I always thought, and I'm an athlete. I've always been an athlete. I did yoga. I was doing all of it. I'd go to, went to a chiropractor even, and just could not figure it out. But the auto transplant fixed it and it was great. Now, let's circle back because truly, I hope what I have just told you is like, I am doing so much better. I hope you can hear it in my voice. I have a semblance of my life back where I can go and hang out with people and really like enjoy myself. And I'm not having to be like, 30 minutes in, like, oh my God, I'm in so much pain. Like, I'm not, my pain predominantly is not taking over my life. However, there have been some challenges. And so, as people know, the anatomy of Nutcracker syndrome, where your left renal vein is being compressed by the aorta and the superior mesenteric artery, right below that is your superior mesenteric artery, the syndrome, which is where your the third portion of your duodenum, I believe is how you say that, duodenum, is also being compressed. So I had a very severe case of nutcracker. Like when you look on the CT, it is pain, more as pancake as pancake can be, baby. And so, but nobody was like, oh yeah, you have S mass either. At the time, I was very nauseous, loss of appetite, sure. I was having like intermittent pain with eating and intermittent vomiting, but not anytime I'd bring up S mass, it was never, it was very much just you know, this more Nutcracker, your symptoms more aligned with Nutcracker, blah, 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 those type things. So I was like, you know what? Okay. Well, whenever I had the auto transplant, about 5, 6 months in, I'm still having pretty severe loss of appetite and nausea, and I'm starting to get the intermittent pain with eating and intermittent vomiting. So I'm starting to think, oh no, are we looking at superior mesenteric artery syndrome now? So I went and had all of that testing done. I did the barium swallow. I did the endoscopy where they went in. I also had them biopsy the small intestine for me to see if mast cells were present. They did show an elevation of mast cells, however. And once I learned more from my immunologist, who actually is well versed in MCAS, she actually told me that it's not necessarily having an elevation of mast cells in the biopsy, it's what the biopsy looks like. So are we looking, are the cells uniform? Are they not? Are they close together? Are they far apart? That's more indicative of whether you have mast cell or not. So she's currently trying to get her hand on that stain so that she can look and give me a little bit more information behind that. So I went through, it did the whole SMAP thing. I even went and saw some mall specialists, which was very fucking frustrating, I have to admit. And maybe some of you all in here will resonate with this because the majority of the mall's people I went and saw were like, you're not anorexic. And I was like, oh boy. I could tell you 270 different ways on how problematic that is. I understand where you're coming from. However, does somebody have to wither away to the very last degree of their life for you to even give a shit? That's a whole nother episode. I digress. I go have all the testing for malls. We rule out a bunch of other stuff. And they're just saying, hey, I don't think this is GI related. And I'm also just like, okay, that's great. I'm not necessarily looking for something to be wrong, but I just know my body and I'm like, something's wrong. Like, loss of appetite, nausea, intermittent vomiting, intermittent pain with eating. And again, not every time. And I do agree that with superior mesenteric artery syndrome, it's going to be painful every time you eat. So I went and had all of that testing done. It all came back negative. That then, and I'm still dealing with some GI issues. I'm still dealing with loss of appetite. I'm still dealing with nausea. So my challenge has been just getting in enough caloric intake for me to be able to like sustain just like my resting maybe like whatever the calories that I burn and just resting. But what I will say from that is there's been some new diagnoses have come. So as hope maybe some of us know and maybe not, just as like a reminder to you all, there's a if you have vascular compressions, I have at least not met anybody yet. Let me know, drop a comment that there's not comorbidities present. So endometriosis is one. I was diagnosed with stage four endometriosis at the very beginning of this whole vascular compression nightmare. POTS. Already told you I have POTS. Posterior orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, EDS, people that are hypermobile. Oh, I will let you all know I have gotten a second and third opinion on EDS for myself. All three have been like, we don't think you have hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos. Obviously, some of us are like, well, what about the vascular kind? And every single one of them have told me, you're a 35-year-old woman. Every individual who has demonstrated to have like vascular EDS have been those individuals we would have known by now. You would have had something happen. It would have also been like you would have a family history of it. So I have yet, some of the things I haven't done yet is I have not gotten a genetic test for Ehlers-Danlos. All three, and again, this is three separate opinions, have said, listen, you can do this. It's out of pocket for you to do it. So we're not going to tell you not to do it. However, this has been my experience with people doing it. It's the likelihood of it all coming back negative. So I have up to this point, and just because of my finances and my medical bills, I've decided not to do the genetic testing yet. However, and this brings me to one of my new diagnoses. I obviously said that I've seen three rheumatologists at this point. And the reason why I saw this last one a couple of weeks ago is my immunologist, Dr. Gallant Swafford, or Gallant Swafford, actually, is how I learned to say it. She is with National Jewish and very thorough. I loved her. She's who I saw for mast cell. And I'm still seeing, I still need to do a 24-hour urine collection and some other things. I brought up autoimmune stuff and I had not fully looked into that. I talked about Ehlers-Danlos, things like that. So she referred me to this rheumatologist at National Jewish. I go see her and I'm like, listen, I'm not really here. Like, I just kind of want to pick your brain. I'm not here to fish for a diagnosis. However, the autoimmune side of things I haven't really explored and I'd like to be more educated on it. Here's what I know about the vascular compression space. I educated her just like I've educated you all because she was another doctor who had no idea what these things were, but very open to learning about them and very open to collaborating. And she was the first rheumatologist to actually do blood work. Now, it wasn't the genetic testing, but she still did blood work. And this is, I actually just got the results this morning, and it's a little sad. But it is what it is. So she did a CRP number, which came back normal. That was awesome. This was the first round that came back. It was all normal. She also did a couple other inflammatory markers, and they all came back normal. That was great. I actually thought, oh, awesome, this is all great. Nothing's autoimmune. Well, then this morning I wake up and it's like, you have new test results. And I was like, I thought they all came through. Well, no, they didn't. These just took a little bit longer. This is my CCP numbers. I'll be honest with you. I don't even, let me see what CCP stands for. CCP, it's the IgG in the IgA concentration, is what this says on here. The cyclic citrullinated peptide. So it's an antibody. It's testing for antibodies. Themes here. Is measured in a blood test primarily for diagnosing and monitoring rheumatoid arthritis. Well, my numbers came back, at least for that, they came back high. They're weak positive, I will say. So anything below a 20 is negative, and mine's a 25, so that's a weak positive. And then my other test that I did that also came back not great is the, let's see, what is the, let's see, an ANA, which is anti-nuclear antibody test, where it shows antibodies indicating the level of immune response with higher numbers suggesting a greater likelihood of an autoimmune condition, such as lupus, inflammatory arthritis. I think scleroderma was another one. I forget if I'm saying that correctly. That also came back up. That is. We're looking at the pattern of it is speckled, it's saying. I'm not 100% sure what that means just yet. I do have a high number indicating a strong immune response and higher probability of an autoimmune disease. So, what I don't have a proper diagnosis just yet. I need to have that follow-up with this particular rheumatologist. But one of the things that that did bring me to, obviously, because what do? We get the test results. We immediately go to the internet because I'm not sitting around ruminating. I want to kind of get my head wrapped around it so I can be prepared when I go to that appointment. Some of the things that obviously brought up, like lupus, but there is something called mixed connective tissue disease. Never heard of it. It's not the same as Ehlers-Danlos. If I were to mixed connective tissue disease versus EDS, let's see what comes up. I remember I actually looked at this morning. It was a pretty nice, what do you call it? A nice little, not a bracket, like a table, if you will. And I thought it was really interesting because it was essentially showing here it is. So mixed connective tissue disease is an autoimmune disease, whereas Ehlers-Danlos is a genetic collagen disorder. There's different lab tests that they're going to look at. And another thing with EDS that I have appreciated about my last two rheumatologists is that they have been like, listen, there's so much we don't know about Ehlers-Danlos. There's so much we don't know about connective tissue disorders. So just because we don't think that you have it doesn't mean you don't. There's just no way to measure the biomarkers for it. So main problems with like mixed connective tissue is inflammation, immune-mediated tissue injury, whereas like EDS is like joint instability, hypermobility, things like that. Their EDS, well, mixed connective tissue disease is that there's a higher likelihood of organs being involved. Now, something I looked at too, is that the it's not necessarily saying that if this is mixed connective tissue disease for me, and again, if I am diagnosed with that, and the more I learn about it, I'll do another episode on it just so you all can be aware and know how to navigate that for yourself if it pertains to you. It's not necessarily saying that mixed connective tissue disease is the reason I got vascular conditions, because that was my big like, is this the driving force? And from what I have gathered, it doesn't necessarily cause structural compressions. However, it can have obviously effect on the blood vessels. But it's not necessarily the cause of. And I think it's really like correlation doesn't mean causation, just as a reminder. That's obviously been beaten into my head as an academic, but and I let them know that. I let my doctors know, like, hey, I'm not necessarily, I don't know if I'm ever going to know the cause of why these vascular compressions happen. I don't know if any of our lifetimes, any of us will know that unless further research is done. And since it predominantly affects women, is that going to happen? Probably not. I don't know, especially with this administration. But with that being said, it's the biggest thing I'm trying to do now, and what I tell every doctor is my body severely broke down. And I'm trying to figure out what the puzzle pieces are that led to that. One of the things it is talking about with mixed connective tissue disease is that it can worsen existing compressions. So, as some of us know with Nutcracker, at least, there's Nutcracker phenomenon, which is, hey, you got the anatomy for this, babe. You got the anatomy. As long as you're not symptomatic, we're not going to treat it. But when those symptoms come, I'm going to let you know there's not a lot of great options because they're pretty invasive, right? So there could be that, right? Like this mixed connective tissue didn't necessarily cause it, but it could have exacerbated it. So again, it's like a perfect storm. But my biggest thing on this year journey is my body broke down for a reason. And the kindest and most compassionate thing I can do for myself is make sure I'm not leaving a stone unturned that needs medical intervention, that needs pharmaceutical intervention, whatever it is, right? Maybe not even that, maybe like a holistic herbal intervention. But if I don't know what the diagnosis is, then I'm not going to know how to treat it. And that's the more you advocate for yourself in this medical space, it's the kindest thing you can do. Just as much as it's traumatic, it's also saying, when I go to these doctor's appointments and I am very traumatized continuing to go back. And we're at a year now, and I still have doctor's appointments. I likely also, and I'll transition into this next, as hopefully I won't start crying when I talk about it, as I likely have more procedures on the docket. I keep reminding myself, this is the kindest thing you can do for yourself, is to follow through with this doctor's appointment, even if they say, yeah, I think you're fine. Yeah, you're good. Let's run the test, but I don't think anything's going to come from it. Always say yes and always follow through with those things. Now, I want to intersect this with the fact that I do have insurance, and I have insurance through my employer, and my insurance plan is fairly good. So I do have more mobility because of that. So I never ever want to make it seem like I am blinded to the fact that I'm not aware of that. And that some of you listening to this are like, well, that's all great for you, Simone. I don't have insurance. I have Medicaid. 2026 is coming, and premiums are about to increase. Like I am standing with you on the front lines of that, like, protest. So that is some of the updates I wanted to provide you. Now, the last thing I want to talk about When I started the whole fascial decompression journey, and even prior to being diagnosed with May Thurner and with Nutcracker, I went in for a leg ultrasound and I was told I had vascular insufficiency in my legs, with my left leg being worse than my right. And with May Thurner, that's typical because of how the anatomy is set up. So the thought was, I was told at that point, hey, like with your vascular insufficiency in your legs, like we can go in and ablate those. However, with you having May Thurner, it's likely the May Thurner causing the reflux in your legs, the pain in your legs. So we see when you fix that first, fixes your legs, you don't have to ablate the legs. And I was like, makes sense to me. Gravity is a thing. It hasn't changed. So go fix May Thurner. I did after, and this was also, I fixed May Thurner prior to Nutcracker. So a lot of people, rant and rave about making sure you treat top to bottom. And I do think that that is warranted to some degree. For myself, I was having enough pain in my pelvic and below that I was like, if this makes my Nutcracker worse, sure, but like I've got to do something. So I fix my May Thurner, do the stent for that. My legs do get better. And I even went, this was before my auto transplant, but after the May Thurner stent, I go have another leg ultrasound because I'm starting to have some, I still have leg symptoms. And they're like, hey, your leg ultrasound actually came back better. You still have vascular insufficiency, but it's not as bad. And I was like, that's awesome, right? Like the stent's doing what it needs to do. I'm likely not going to have this, these leg ablations or whatever it is that you have done. So then I go have Nutcracker syndrome auto transplant surgery, and my legs got a lot better. As far as like, I wasn't having this excruciating sciatica pain down my left leg. Well, as the year has gone on, I've just noticed one of the things, and I posted about this on social media in one of my stories, is a couple months ago, they put needles all over my body, like down to my toes, up to the top of my head. And anytime my acupuncturist would take a needle out, every now and then, one of the holes that with the small little needle will just bleed a smidge, like a little speck of blood. And not always either, because I don't want those people that haven't done acupuncture, you're like, oh, hell no, I'm not doing that. Acupuncture is amazing. Okay. Even with that, I would still go. It doesn't hurt. So she started making note that whenever I would have like a speck of blood show up that was above my hips, it was clean, bright red, beautiful looking blood. Anything hips below was like black, dark, very like, oh, I know what this is. There's some reflux happening. This blood is not getting cleaned. This is toxic blood. Yay, yay, yay. And I was also starting to have symptoms of like midday to later in the day, my ankles and my feet were starting to swell. I was getting these deep aches in my calves and my ankles. And I was like, well, it's probably just because like I'm getting back and I'm walking more now that I'm more active. But then it just finally, I was like, you know what? My out-of-pocket max and my, deductible are met. Let me just go get this leg ultrasound. So I went to a new spot. I went to RA Endovascular in Denver. I had heard that they do really expensive 90-minute long tilt table leg ultrasounds. And I was like, sign me up. So I get on the calendar. I just had that done last week. And she's doing the whole thing. She's even checking for veins that I remember my previous leg ultrasound didn't even look at. And I get the results back, and it is not good. I have a lot of issues. I have a genetic abnormality in my right femoral vein, in my groin area, where the vein, instead of doing what it's supposed to do normally, it wraps around the femoral artery. I still haven't had my follow-up for that just yet. But not only that, so the femoral vein, just so you all know, for those that don't, is a part of the deep system, the deep vascular system in the body near the legs. To my knowledge, there's nothing you can do to treat that. However, I do have a lot of issues in my small vascular system with pretty dilated veins, 8 millimeters, 12 millimeters, when you're supposed to be at 2 to 4 millimeters with 5 seconds of reflux, 3.7 seconds of reflux. When medically significant is like, I think for the small system, I forget if it's like 0.5 for the small system, 1.5 seconds for the small system, 1 second for the deep system, or maybe it's vice versa. So the fact that I've got 5 seconds and 3.7 seconds and these dilated veins that are 2 and 3 times larger than they're supposed to be, it ain't good. It ain't good. So I have that follow-up on January 6th. And the biggest kind of punch to the gut for me is no, like looking at that ultrasound, seeing the bilateral issues, realizing we're not just looking at reflux, we're looking at valve failure. And I don't necessarily know, again, correlation doesn't equal causation. But a lot of it does point toward when your body has been refluxing blood for so long, there is damage. There's an aftermath to it. Man, and I feel like this is where I'm gonna get emotional. So many of us are, we've done our due diligence. We've gone to the ER. We've gotten the CTs. We've gotten more radiation than we need to fucking have in our bodies. And it was constantly missed. And I think this realization of knowing that I'm going to need to have these procedures, and I'm not sure maybe I can do all of the issues in my legs at once. I don't think I can, because it's like both great saphenous veins in both legs, and then I have like my right leg has all these other like small veins that are also problematic. I also need to talk to them because I don't know. They might be like, "Hey, you have all these issues, but if we just fix this one, it'll fix everything." Like that would be amazing if I hear that. However, I'm not getting my hopes up. The trauma that our bodies have to accrue simply because the medical community has neglected us is really hard. You know, Kyle, today when we were on the way back and I was kind of giving him the update on everything, he just said, "Well, what does this mean for ski season? Because we're really big into snowboarding and skiing." I was like, "I don't know. I don't know if I'll even be able to ski." And that's been something for the last 2 years I've been looking forward to doing, and I haven't been able to do it all. Part of my identity is being an athlete, and I can't do that. I did just start going to yoga again. Last Sunday was my first yoga class in over a year, and it's really challenging. I can mentally, my body still, I mentally feel like my body is still what it was prior to all of this. And then I go to that yoga class, and thank God the lights were dim and you couldn't tell that I was just like streaming tears the whole time. Because I just feel like I'm living in a foreigner's body and it's really challenging. So I would probably say, physically, I am doing so much better. I have my life back. I have people that have seen me prior to the auto transplant after they're like, "Wow, you have blood in your face," and you can like just tell physically that you're doing so much better. You can tell you needed the surgery, the whole nine yards. I'm doing so much more at work and all these different things. Obviously, I'm doing the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast. I created my own business as well called the COPE Center, which is short for the Center for Optimal Psychological Education and Injury and Rehabilitation, which is my expertise in trying to work with the medical community on enhancing their understanding of the psychological side of all this bullshit we go through. I will probably say the thing that I've struggled with the most, because, like, for example, with my legs, we'll go get that shit fixed. Right? Like, this is a part of me that's just like, girl, we'll go get that shit fixed. It has still been a massive emotional roller coaster for me. So, one of the things I do want to end this, actually, I don't want to end the episode now because I do want to talk about two other things. So, the emotional roller coaster, let's go back to that, has been probably the hardest for me. My landscape has changed. My relationship with my family has changed. And that's been really hard. And there's been a lot of grief with that on my side of things. To try to navigate that, thankfully, I have Kyle, my partner, which just to let you all know, we met and it was like 3 to 5 months later I was diagnosed with all this. So our whole relationship has been medical bullshit. And there is a deep resentment for that, of like our honeymoon phase being ripped from us. This year also, I've had my fair share of ER visits. So if you are post-auto transplant and you're like, what is this next year going to look like? I did go to the ER twice for pain that was located in the transplanted kidney area. Now, what's hard about that is your appendix is also there. So if you still got that, shit, is it appendicitis? I don't know, my right or my yeah my right ovary's right there, my remaining ovary, and I have a massive track record with chronic ovarian cyst rupturing. So I go to the ER and it's like, every time I've gone, I come out and they're like, my white blood cell count's elevated. There's probably some infection. Maybe there was a small cyst that did rupture, whatever it might be. But those ER visits, it's like, if I would, especially in the first year, if you're having pain in that area, just go to the ER. It's better to know than not. Something else, though, that I did learn is once you have the auto transplant, you are now labeled as a transplant patient. And that was something I was really interesting to me. Circling back to the urinary tract infections I was talking to you all about, there was one time I was starting to get UTI symptoms, and I called, like with my insurance, I can get on the app and I can do like a 24-hour talk to a doctor 24 hours or whatever. So the doctor comes on and I'm chatting with them, and she's like, "Oh, you've had a transplant, go to the ER." And I'm really learning that. That's just one example of like the moment somebody sees that I have a transplant, they're like, "We're not just going to give you antibiotics and see if it goes away. You are living in a completely weird body to us. And no matter what your transplant is, we're just going to tell you to go to the ER." And that's been a little annoying because it's like, can you not just give me the fucking antibiotics? We'll go to the pharmacy, do them, and then I don't have to do the whole trauma thing, going to the ER, blah, blah. However, I will also say this. Now, when I go to the ER and they're like, tell us what's going on. And I'm like, I just had a kidney auto transplant 3 months, 6 months ago, whatever it is. They're like, I have seen a bit of a red carpet be rolled out, which is nice. And it also pisses me the fuck off. Because I'm like, where was this before? Where is this for all the other people? Right? Yeah, I got to go get an auto transplant for you all to like take anything seriously. That's another episode. Y'all have heard me sprinkle that throughout most of the episodes. It's very frustrating. Now, I want the thing I do want to say is that I have had two other surgeries this year. I am financially resourceful. Now, is being financially resourceful mean that I'm making the best decisions for my medical trauma? I don't know. I don't know. I decided my out-of-pocket max and deductible were met in April of this year, 2025. And I was like, you know what? I go to my primary care. He's amazing. And I was like, can you just send me the referrals to all these specialists? That's why I went and got MALS checked, SMAS checked, superior mesenteric artery syndrome checked, did the whole thing. Because I was like, it's all free for the next however many months, 8 months. I have universal health care. Not really, but makes you think you do. Let's go get all this done. So I go and do that, and I find out I first go to my first immunologist appointment, and I go in and I'm like, hey, I'm like starting to learn more about mast cells and how like endometriosis often has a high profile of mast cells in them. So I have endometriosis. From what I've gathered on how to acquire an MCAS diagnosis is that you have to have three bodily organs affected by mast cells or to show an abnormal amount of mast cells. So I have endometriosis. I had the biopsy, small intestine biopsy come back. And I've always dealt with chronic sinus infections. And I was actually reading that that can be a part of one of the bodily systems that if you have elevated mast cell come back in the sinus biopsy, that that could be the third kind of nail in the coffin for an MCAS diagnosis. Now, I go see this immunologist, not even thinking about my nose per se, like not even thinking about like we need to go have surgery on my nose at all. Just like, hey, I want to talk about MCAS. All he knew up to that point is like, we'll just do your trip taste test, and that's it. Like, Dr. Ebati is amazing. He was such a great provider, but like just didn't know he's not an MCAS provider. So he's like, okay, well, while we have you here, let me look up your nose. He looks on my nose and he's like, girl, your turbinates are huge. And I wonder why you can't breathe. I was like, what the fuck's a turbinate? Okay. And so he's like, well, let's before you leave, are you cool while you're here? We'll do like the little 67 needle pricks on your back to see if you're allergic to anything. I was like, yeah, let's do it. So we do it, and I'm not allergic to anything. It all comes back negative. And he's like, okay, I'm going to refer you to an ENT, so an ear, nose, and throat doctor, because I'm pretty sure you need to have a turbinate reduction, and that's really going to help. I go see the ENT, Dr. Reichman. He's amazing, probably one of the better surgeons I've had, and I have a great medical team. I go see him, and I'm just like, yeah. Dr. Ibadi sent me here. I promised myself 2 years ago that I would always follow through. And again, this is another reason why I'm glad I did this. I go see him. He looks at my nose and he's like, yeah, this isn't looking great. He said, let's get you. I go do like a 1 minute CT scan of my face. It pops up immediately. And he's like, girl, you've got like a, like, I think he said moderate to severe deviated septum. Turbinates are crazy. And you've got like a whack job of a chronic sinus infection, like a sinus infection going on. So he says, what I'm going to do, I'm going to prescribe you some antibiotics. I'm going to give you some steroids. And we all know, we all fucking hate steroids. But I'm like, you know what? I'll do it. And go back 3 weeks later, another CT, and my sinus infection is worse. And he was like, oh, this isn't good. This means your problems are structural. The infection is antibiotic resistant, and it's because it can't get out. Because of structurally, your nose is not allowing it to get out. So I go have a septoplasty, which is fixing my deviated septum, and a turbinate reduction. That was July 31st of this year. And I'm joking around. I'm just like, hey, these are going to be like spa days in comparison. No. So any type of surgery you have on your face, that was not good. That was awful surgery for me. Thankfully, it only lasted 5 days, and then I've never been able to breathe better. I have looked up that there is some research of ENTs looking at the connection between structural issues of the face and not being able to breathe really well, and connection to POTS, and how a lot of people who have been diagnosed with POTS, more of the issue is that you have, it's an oxygen, like you're not able to breathe well, and that's not really helping your heart. So, as a reminder, I go get diagnosed with POTS 6 months after the auto transplant. So, around like the beginning of July, and it's moderate in behavior. A couple of weeks later, I go and have my sinus surgery. And then a couple months after the sinus surgery, I go back for a follow-up, and he's like, your POTS looks amazing. You basically, it's like non-existent to mild at this point, barring that you keep with your intervention. Like, I'm not cured of it. Do I have the data to directly correlate the septoplasty and turbinate reduction to my POTS? No. Is it interesting? Absolutely. I've also think I spoke about some dental stuff on this podcast as well. I was learning too. So for me, at night, I would often breathe through my mouth because I couldn't breathe through my nose. And I would wake up and I'd be even more congested than when I went to bed. Well, I was learning from a dental assistant about this that if you are a mouth breather at night, that like takes away the saliva, you get dry mouth. That dry mouth leads to like gum disease and different things like that. So I'm just like, okay, like I go back, it'll be in February when I do another dental appointment. I have had my teeth have definitely, I have all my teeth, just so y'all know, and they're white and they do look nice. But I do get, I have had an increase in cavities and things like that when I have good hygiene. And I've had a couple people reach out and be like, oh my gosh, the same thing happened to us. Like great hygiene. Then all of a sudden I came symptomatic with these vascular concussions and my teeth just went south. And I'm like, yep, same here. So hopefully I'll have an update there on the dental side of things. But one other thing I wanted to talk about is I did have my auto transplant at UW Health in Madison, Wisconsin. In the last episode, I talked about my hernia repair surgery. And that was something that definitely came about. I developed a hernia above at the top of my incision that grew pretty quickly. And again, I wasn't doing anything outlandish. The only thing Kyle and I can think about is like one time I was helping him with what do you call it? Gardening and stuff. We were like building a garden bed and we're like, maybe that did it. But I don't remember like doing that. And then the next day waking up and be like, oh my God, I have a hernia. So but when I went to have that hernia surgery, it was like I had one that was visibly, you could visibly see it. And then there were four other the total of four once they got in there. So that hernia surgery was 20 times harder than my auto transplant surgery. Some of it was that they didn't manage my pain well, and I wrote a 10-page single space letter for how that hospital did not navigate that well. But that's something also within that year to be on the lookout for, which is developing hernias in the abdomen, especially if you've had the full open abdominal surgery. You are at a higher risk for hernias. I'm the only person. Now, please drop a comment if you're like, no, I had an auto transplant and I also had to fix a hernia. please drop a comment. Because again, I don't know all of you either. So this isn't overgeneralizing. I, to my knowledge as it stands now, am the only person that I know in this community. And I know there's others, but I mean, the people that I do interact with in this community now that has had a hernia post-operatively for an auto transplant. So drop a comment if it's more common, if you're like, no, that's definitely been me. But for the most part, we're still not done. We are now looking at some leg procedures to fix the valve failures in my legs. We are looking at more testing for this potential mixed connective tissue disease. Maybe it's something else. And we will just go from there. But if I could really tie it up, it's like this kidney auto transplant, I would never, ever, ever. I don't regret at all having it. It gave me my life back. And one thing I do want to end on is saying this. A couple months after my auto transplant, I was kind of chatting with Kyle and just being like, yeah, that was really tough. And he like interrupted me and he was like, very compassionately, was just like, I really wish you would stop downplaying what you just went through. Because you looked like a cancer patient, like you were dying. And I remember sobbing because I was just like, you're right. And I think one of the ways we cope, especially up to the point of getting the actual big surgery, is to downplay, right? Whether that's like downplaying what the pain is when you go and talk to the doctor, which I never do. I've always learned that. I always, when you're a chronic pain girly or boy, I always am like, whatever I am, I put two more on that. That's been my kind of math equation in my head, because I'm like, I don't need y'all to impose a traditional heteronormative pain scale upon me. Okay. But I will say that when he said that, a lot of the reason why I would say the hardest thing postoperatively and still at a year has been the emotional journey, is because I finally have allowed myself to be like, I was gonna die. And really leaning in and trying to emotionally process my near-death experience, which I don't necessarily want to bring this up to cause turmoil for you. And it's also very, very important from a psychological standpoint to accept what is happening as what it is. And when you're dealing with a compression, when you're dealing with a diagnosis where not only most of the medical community knows nothing about it, which is so much more isolating and feels so much more helpless, I think that lends to even more why you don't call it what it is, which is that you're dying, you know? And these vascular compressions have a tendency of reminding us of our impermanence. And so I'm really, a lot of the emotional turmoil is me dealing with that. And I will say, leading into starting year two for me, I am already on the books to start pretty intensive ketamine therapy here in Denver, where they are 6 sessions that are completed within a 4-week time frame, which is noted as being like the best. You get the best results doing that. It is out of pocket. I am going to be doing a series on here of my experience with it, so that anybody else that is interested in doing ketamine therapy to help you navigate medical issues, complex trauma, whatever it is, that hopefully that can give you some insights onto what my journey's like, empower you to go and do the same. And again, I am aware that there is a financial barrier there because it's not covered by insurance. But again, I am an advocate and an educator at the heart of who I am. So I'm hoping that that information will, I am just hoping that my case study of one me and what I am sharing with you all is helpful, and that you don't feel alone in this, because I cannot describe how alone I felt when I first got the diagnosis. The Facebook group helped, of course, but it was still just so fucking overwhelming figuring out like what was the first step. So I wanted to give you all this 1-year auto transplant update. We made it. I don't, if I look back at the last year, I don't really know where it went. I feel like I blacked out a little bit, but we're on the other side. We are doing so, 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 so much better. And we still have things to fix. And I think that's the vascular compression world. And I just want to encourage you to think about every doctor's appointment you go to, every time you get on and you try to do your research. That is you compassionately loving yourself. And continue to do that. Even listening to these episodes is the same thing. So before we end, as with some of my episodes where they're solo in nature, I just want us to ground ourselves in the present moment, bring gratitude to ourselves for all that we have done for ourselves in this space. And so I want to invite you, if you feel comfortable and you're willing, wherever you are at, to take that full deep inhale through your nose. Maybe feel your chest expand, your shoulders rise a little bit. And then when you're ready, either through your nose or your mouth, slow exhale, feeling yourself become more grounded in this space. Another full deep inhale. Slow exhale. I'm going to invite you to stay with this cycle, maybe breathing in gratitude for self, breathing out gratitude for self, as long as you would like. Just know that you're not alone, and you're welcome to stay with that breathing pattern into the next episode or into whatever you have on your agenda for today. I am sending you all very big hugs.